From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Last year, George Foreman did something that defied conventional wisdom. At the age of 45, he won back the title of heavyweight champion of the world. He had retired from boxing in 1977 when he had a religious experience and decided to preach. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Foreman about his jabs and his preaching and why he thinks the two are compatible. Foreman has written a new autobiography. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews two new biographies she recommends for summer reading. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Lots of middle-aged people considered it a victory when George Foreman recaptured the world heavyweight title last November at the age of 45. Foreman was 24 when he first won the title in a fight against Joe Frazier back in 1973. Foreman lost the title to Muhammad Ali in 74. 3 years later, after losing a fight, he had a religious experience and retired from boxing to take up preaching. Foreman was ordained in 1978 and soon started his own church and youth center in Houston. He says he re-entered the ring in 1987 because he needed money. Now George Foreman has a new autobiography called By George. Anger used to motivate him in the ring. I asked him what motivates him now that he's a preacher in his mid-40s.
Yeah, I had this killer instinct. I had built up over the years from my life. I'd consider everything that bad had happened to me, what people had done to me, and that would be my motivating thing to get in the ring and hate this guy and try to kill him. Now, 10 years later, 20 years later, after I'm no longer a champion, I'm going back into boxing, and I've got to win. And I quit boxing in 77 because I no longer had this killer instinct. So I started teaching kids at the youth center to box, get a chip off the shoulder. Don't try to hurt anybody. You don't need to be angry. Boxing is good for you, but don't hurt anybody. So I learned, by teaching, I learned, too, how to pursue boxing and never a punch or shot in anger.
But you're hitting and you're hurting the person, whether it's in anger or not. So as a religious man, how did you feel about reentering the ring, knowing whether you were motivated by anger or not? You were still delivering blows and hopefully knockout blows.
It became then a profession to me. And it became a sport where you practice hard, and the other guy that you're facing, he practiced hard. It's a sport. You hug prior to the boxing match. There's no longer this staring down. And no matter what you do, the most safest thing that you can have in a boxing ring is not a headgear, like I say all the time, but compassion for the guy, knowing when, hey, you can't hurt this guy anymore. Winning the fight and not hurting the guy. And believe me, in boxing, it's the granddaddy of even chess. Man, hand-to-hand, man-to-man, woman against woman or whatever, there's nothing wrong with boxing. It's the granddaddy of all sports. I mean, to ping pong itself, without boxing, it never would have been a game of ping pong.
You talk about compassion. Can you tell me a time when you were in the ring when you didn't do something you could have done out of compassion for your opponent?
Oh, a lot of times I've been almost beat up because once you cross that road, when you knew the guys, you know a guy, I've had too much, I've hit him too much, and you tell a referee, hey, he's had enough, ref. I'm not going to kill this guy. And then the ref doesn't stop the fight. He tells me, go on, but I know I've hurt this guy. So once you make that point where you're not going to hurt him anymore, you can't jump into that boat again. Then the guy starts hitting me, and he knows, hey, George is not going to hurt me. I've had this happen to me so many times.
So you let somebody hit you rather than...
Well, I try to avoid. I try to get out of the way because I ease up. I gauge my punches, not only to win, but to make sure I don't hurt a guy. And the guy can feel that, and he goes off on you. So it's happened to me a lot.
How can you tell that your opponent is at the point where if you hit him hard, you will deliver a serious blow and hurt him?
Well, there's a look of... please have mercy on me, that they won't show the referee. They won't show their corner, but it's there. They have this heart And they don't want the world to know either that I just can't take it anymore. I wish I could quit, but I can't. And you got to see that because I've experienced it myself. I know how it is. And I can look into and see, hey, this is it. Now I better change. He's not going to quit. He's not going down. I'm his only. And there's an old Bible saying, the merciful will obtain mercy. So I always try to extend that merciful hand.
No, back to compassion. You say you've developed compassion in the ring. Does that ever get in the way?
Not for me, because once you're out of boxing, you want that to rule your life. I never get into the ring and I want to be a split personality. What you see is what you get. And I tell my kids all the time, because they're watching me, I'm in the ring. I don't want them to see one daddy at home who's picking him up, loving him and kissing him, and another guy in the ring who's frowning, who's mean, staring a guy down. I am the same guy no matter what. And so nothing ever gets in my way because I'm the same guy. But if I try to this metamorphosis of transforming myself into this character and then recreating him after the fight is over, things would get in the way.
George Foreman is my guest, and he has a new autobiography. Is it harder to take blows and to take pain now in your mid-40s than it was when you started boxing?
Not at all. As a matter of fact, I think the years have enabled me to be a lot stronger. Because you focus. You note, hey, I'm doing it for a reason now. When I was younger, I didn't understand pain. When things hurt, they hurt. And you try to stay away from them. But as a man, you know why you're doing it, the reason you're doing it. And the pain is lesser for some reason.
Because you know why you're doing it?
Or you know why.
Is there something else you know, too, now about how to deal with pain?
You understand that without the old saying, no pain, no gain. It's no slogan anymore to me. It's about life itself.
Do you feel more vulnerable in your mid-40s than you used to? That a blow could do more serious damage than it could? Or that you'll heal more slowly than you used to?
Not at all. I figure that I feel like I'm the standard bearer for the 21st century. As we move into another century, someone has got to take us into. We won't be able to say, going into a new century, you're an old man, you're 35. Someone has got to lead us into the promised land. And one day, someone is going to have to say, hey, everybody can pursue dreams. I'm in that demographic of 45, 55. This will never be able to, no one will ever be able to erase that I was heavyweight champ of the world, not on the seniors tour, heavyweight champ of the world at 45. I'm 46 now, of course. And it's something that I'm going to wipe away the fear of being hurt, the fear of it can't be done. And Olympians, basketball players, even cheerleaders are going to be active beyond 40 because of what we're doing now.
Now, let me flip back a bunch of years and get back to when you were a teenager. You started off as a street fighter. Mm-hmm. How did that affect your approach to boxing when you started to box?
Devastating, because I met Doc Brodus, my first boxing coach, in 66 in the Job Corps Center. I said, hey, I want to be a boxer. He said, okay, you're big enough, you're ugly enough, come on down to the gym. I remember going down to the gym, and he put me in a ring with a little guy, a little skinny guy, no muscles, you can see his ribs. I said, boy, I invited all my friends to watch my boxing match. I thought it was going to be just like on the streets. Jumped in the ring, I was able to land one blow. The guy would move out of the way and hit me with this thing called a jab. And I'd charge him and try to grab him, and the referees would say, you can't wrestle. So it was a hard thing to abandon my street fighting tactics and move into another thing where I had to learn how to do box. I had to learn a new style, a whole new existence of fighting.
What was the hardest thing to give up from your street fighting style?
Grabbing. In the streets, I'd hit you and hit you. If you move out of the way, I would grab you and get you. In the ring, you were not able to, you can only use your fist. You can't open your hand and grab anyone. Plus, I wanted to bite too, but he had a mouthpiece.
Now, what about the kind of finesse that your trainer was trying to teach you?
Yeah, it was a long time before I could really comprehend what he was saying. George, you're not going to be able to just knock everybody out and run over everybody. You're going to have to learn this sport. And it took a few defeats before I decided I had to dedicate my life to learning more than just being powerful and strong. I had to learn this as a sport, jabbing and finesse, as you call it.
Did you used to psych yourself up before you entered the ring to get yourself to be really angry or to really hate your opponent?
Yeah, Dick Sattler, my first trainer, manager In 69, I told him I wanted to be a boxer. He said he would teach me how to be a boxer, and I'd move in the ring and practice every day, styles, dancing, prancing. And I really wanted to be the next Muhammad Ali, that kind of stuff. So my first boxing match in Madison Square Garden, 1969, Donald Waldheim. Dick Sadler gets me into the dressing room. He rubs me down. He takes water away from me for 2 days. Then he starts cussing. This blankety blank is trying to stop your life. You go out there, and I mean, you knock him out. You hit him here. If he hides, you hit him behind. And he cusses and cusses and cusses. You hear me? Push him like this. And he asks me to push him, and I pushes him. By the time I get into that ring, I'm like a wind-up killer. And I thought he was going to let me be a boxer. From that point on, he would wind me up like a doll every time. It was not about my psyching myself up. He would engineer this creature.
He engineered it. Was that effective for you?
Oh, yes. When I got into that ring, sorry for a guy who didn't know how to protect himself. I remember boxing a guy, I think maybe in Seattle, Washington. I can't remember his name. We're matched, and I jumped out on this kid, and I tried to hit him, and I missed him. And I tried to hit him again. I'd miss him. I'd hit him in the back. Finally, I barely missed him, and he hit the floor. People threw candy wrappers, cigarette butts. They were booing. I said, "Get up, man. Get up. Don't do this." And later on after the fight, he walked up to me, and he saw I was really feeling down about what happened. They counted him out, but he wasn't out. He looked me in the eye. He said, "You know, you really want to kill someone, don't you?" He said, "That's what you wanted. You wanted to kill me." He said, "I wasn't going to get up for you to kill me."
Huh.
Do you understand? So I had this killer instinct, and it wasn't. And the sad thing, I'm upset with a guy because he won't get up and let me kill him. And for the first time, I realized that the best thing he could have done was just stay down there.
Now, so you got really psyched up with this killing instinct to get into the ring. Could you turn that off when a match was over?
You know, it's strange because you think you can turn it off, but later on you're fighting once, twice, sometimes three times in a month. You go home and you say to yourself, "It's over now. I'm going to go back." Finally, this stuff follows you around all the time. And if you're not careful, people see the best side of you in the ring. The awful side of you is outside of the ring. As you get closer, I'm having knockout after knockout. I'm starting to look at myself in the mirror. I see this body. I see this face. I see this man who's going to be heavyweight champ of the world. He is the king of men. He can beat anybody in the room. And you get into a room with guys and you start thinking, nobody can whip me. So it wasn't something you could turn on and off. It was something that stayed with you all the time, as a matter of fact. I remember winning a championship of the world. I defeated Joe Frazier. And I remember thinking, I can beat anybody in the world. Anybody. And it followed me around from restaurant, everywhere I would go.
How did that get in the way of things?
It got in the way of my life because I no longer had a life. I mean, I wouldn't meet a friend. I was like, I'm meeting people that I could whip. You know,
right.
Size you up. You know you can't whip me, don't you? Hi. You know you can't whip me. So you lose a life because 24 hours a day you are the heavyweight champ of the world in your mind.
And how did that affect your relationship with women?
Same way. Hey, you're with the best man. You're with the men of men. You're with the best man. You're with the strongest, toughest, mightiest man in the world. And you felt like that. That's why I was so crumbling when I was defeated by Muhammad Ali. I was knocked out in 74. I'd never lost a boxing match as a professional. Counted out. It was like, man, I'm ashamed to go into the room with people now. They're going to know I'm not the best. And you get in a room with a woman, and she knows. She knows that I'm not the best. Maybe I should keep my clothes on. You know, this not only beats you, it's like you are stripped of your manhood.
Because all you were was the all best,
I,
right? That's,
all I was the heavyweight, the best. And now there's someone better, and they all know. You figure I'm going to keep my clothes on. Well, I'm going to put on some dog glasses so they won't know who I am, so they can say, you know, there's one better than you. Like the old saying, mirror, mirror on the wall. And the mirror speak back, oh, there's someone else. I had to live through that, and it devastated my life. I felt like it was the most devastating thing that ever happened to me, because when I lost the title to Muhammad Ali, I felt like I lost my manhood. What I considered manhood.
Now, would you feel that way if you lost a bout now?
Oh, no. It was, I fought Ronnie Lyles back in 76 after losing the title. Because I told people I could have gotten up in the ring in Africa. I could have done this. I could have won. You look for every excuse. But there I am in Caesar's Palace. Ronnie Lyles, a big strong guy, knocked me down. I'm bleeding on the canvas. I jump up. He knocks me down again. Then I knock him down. He has me on the floor bleeding. Finally, after beating the count two or three times, I knock him out. I felt restored again. Like, oh, I'm a man again. It wasn't Muhammad Ali, but I had my manhood again. I believed in myself a little bit. And I thought that people said, oh, George is tough now. So I got it back. Eventually, I lost to Jimmy Young in 77, and I found something even greater than manhood. I found God, you see, and he gave me something. I was able to admit I lost the boxing match and found a little peace within myself, and it has nothing to do with winning a boxing match or losing anything. It's peace of mind.
My guest is the heavyweight champion of the world, George Foreman. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. George Foreman is my guest, and he has a new autobiography. What's the worst blow you ever took?
It happened in divorce court. When the judge said, 50-50, boy. No, but literally, the Ronnie Lyles fight in 76, he hit me so hard, it didn't even hurt. And that's probably the worst you can be hit. It doesn't hurt, because you don't say to yourself, I'm going to stay out of his way. That didn't hurt. You just see, I'm going to get up, and your knees say, no, no, you're not. Your legs won't bring you up. And then you're bleeding. How does that happen? I'm not hurt. That was the worst thing that could ever happen.
Did you get up?
Of course. I had to get up two times. But eventually, I won the boxing match. If it was physical pain, I probably would not have gotten up. You know, someone threw and hit you with a rock on the bone. You say, ouch. And you say, I'm going to hide. But this guy would hit so hard that you were on the floor. You were on the canvas.
Now, what's the blow that hurt the most that you took?
I've never actually been hurt in the ring, and I'll tell you that. Never been hurt. Once I sparred with a guy, and I remember he had a headgear on, forearms. His forearms looked like Popeye the Sailor Man. He was not strong looking at all, but he would throw his fist on your headgear. It felt like someone threw a brick. Like, I'm not going to spar with this guy anymore. I'm paying him to hurt me? No way. But that was the worst I've had. But I've never actually been hurt at all. I've bumped head with guys or something that causes you to swell up, and it makes it look like you're in pain, but I've never had any true pain. I've never lost one tooth so far.
You've been knocked out.
I was knocked down in Africa by Muhammad Ali. When he knocked me down, I stayed on the canvas waiting for the count of eight. When I jumped up, the referee counted me out. But I was never out.
You lost your title in 77, I guess it was.
I lost the title in 74.
74, Zaire, I'm sorry, yeah,
to
right.
Muhammad Ali.
To Muhammad Ali. How did Ali change boxing for you? I don't mean losing the title, but his sense of showmanship and his sense of theatrics for the media. Did that change what you felt you needed to do as a boxer?
Not at all. As a matter of fact, during the time I was in boxing, I really pledged that I would be opposite of Muhammad Ali. I didn't like what he did. I didn't like what he stood for, what he was standing for. I didn't like anything about Muhammad Ali. I would hate anybody even trying to be like this guy. But after I retired from boxing, of course, I became an evangelist. I would preach on the street corners. People would pass me by. I'd shave my beard off, my mustache, my hair. Nobody knew who I was. I was this great big fat guy. And they would just pass me up. And so one night I started screaming, yeah, this is George Foreman, the ex-heavyweight champ of the world, the guy who fought Muhammad Ali. Yes, I fought him, and he hit me, but I could have gotten up. They would stop. Is that George for real? And listen. And I decided, if you want to make them pay some attention to what you're doing, you're going to have to speak up. You're going to have to say something to make people realize. And I would notice whenever a fire truck would go down the street, people would come down in their rollers, nightgowns, but a water truck go by, nobody would pay any attention. So I had to start this on my own, knowing that if I was going to be successful on my second time around, some ballyhoo would have to follow.
So you feel you got some of that from watching Ellie?
Not at all, as a matter of fact. Just from my evangelistic work, I found out if you're going to say, and I tell my kids now, no matter what profession you've got or how much education, the only sure way that you never will starve is you're going to have to learn to sell. Muhammad Ali did a lot of selling that, and his approach was nice and comical, but at the same time, he would, like, call a guy a rabbit or a bear. I make sure I never tease or say anything about anybody.
Now, what else didn't you like about Ali's approach?
Oh, I mean, when I was coming up,
I
just didn't like Muhammad Ali after a while. I was a fan early on, but then I just didn't like the guy. I just didn't like him. I mean, he was, he whipped me. That's number two. But as a rule, when I got back in the boxing the second time, I started to admire him as a man, of course, because of the sacrifices he had taken early on when other guys were doing anything to get a commercial for a soda pop company. Muhammad Ali decided, hey, I want to speak up and I'm going to be a man. I'm going to say and express myself and express what I see in this world. And he sacrificed everything. And even today when I see people ask me about his injuries, I tell them about World War II veterans, you know, who've been in the war, and you're sitting there with them talking, and they'll take off part of their leg and say, oh, I lost this in North Africa. Take off an arm. I lost this, da-da-da-da. You know, they're proud of it because it was for a reason. Now, when I see Muhammad Ali, I don't see a guy that you should feel sorry for. In his mind, I did something. I'm hurt, sure, but I did it for a reason. I see a hero to a lot of people, and I'll never knock him. I don't believe in half the things he talked about. I don't even understand them. But this man is a hero.
Now, you said that when you lost to Ali in 74, that you weren't knocked out. You were just staying down to the count of eight, but when you got up, the referee...
See, we were told, as a fighter, Archie Moore was one of my trainers, and Dick Sattler was his previous trainer and corner man. If you're knocked down, there wasn't any mandatory eight count as there is now. No matter if you're knocked down, you get up, you still have to be counted eight to clear your head up. This time in Africa, they tell me, when you're knocked down, always look to your corner. Don't listen to the referee. Let your corner count. Get your head clear. And when the corner tell you to get up, get up. So I was knocked down, and I looked around and found my corner. They told me to stay down, which is what they're supposed to do. Then they tell me, when they told me to jump up, I jumped up. The fight was over. But I was never out, never. I started thinking, all night I've pursued Muhammad Ali. He covered up with the rope-a-dope. He wouldn't mix it up. I could knock him out if he only mixes it up. And I'm on the floor thinking, now he's going to come out for the kill and try to finish me off. I'm going to knock him out now. That's what I was waiting to do. When I jumped up, they said it was over. The referee counted quick.
So you're angry?
Oh, I was devastated. I'd wake up in the night sweating, thinking, why didn't I just get up? Why did I trust my corner?
What'd you say to the people in your corner? What did you say to the people in your corner?
I fired them. I never worked with them again.
George Foreman. He has a new autobiography called By George. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. George Foreman will be back with us in the second part of our show.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio. Yeah.
Coming up on Fresh Air, we continue our conversation with George Foreman, the heavyweight champion of the world. He'll tell us about a vision of God he had in his dressing room after losing a fight in 1977, a vision that changed his life. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews two new biographies she recommends for summer reading. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of our interview with the heavyweight champion of the world, George Foreman. He first won the title in 1973, lost it in 74, retired from boxing in 77, and regained the title last year at the age of 45. Foreman has a new autobiography called By George. In the first part of our show, we talked about his boxing technique. Now, let me get to 1977, which is the year you gave up fighting. Mm-hmm. After a bout with Jimmy Young in Puerto Rico, that's the night that you found God.
Mm-hmm.
What happened?
Well, it was a 12-round fight, and I wanted to prove to the world that I not only could whip Muhammad Ali, but I had stamina. They said I lost to Muhammad because I didn't have stamina. So I had Jimmy Young in trouble early on in the fight, and I let him off the hook because even my trainer said, "Now, George." I said, "Nope, I'm going to knock him out later on." But after 10 rounds, I couldn't get him. As a matter of fact, he knocked me down once. He was so shocked, he still ran from me. But after 12 rounds, they gave the decision to Jimmy Young. But I felt victorious because I'd proven I could go 12 rounds. Went back into the dressing room. It was extremely hot that night. No air condition, no hot shower back there, nothing. So I had to walk and cool off. And I had this experience as I walked and cooled. Yeah, you got everything. You don't care about this boxing match. You could go home right now to your ranch and retire and die. Sneaked into my conversation. I didn't put it there, and I kept wondering, how did that get in there? After a while, I was overwhelmed with, you're going to die. I heard about athletes dying after exertion, football, basketball, or whatever, baseball. I wasn't prepared to die. And I knew about religion. I just didn't believe in it. It was for poor people who didn't have anything. When I grew up, you see a guy, police shoot him, or you get hit in the head, get a plate in his head. Then you see him in the church. Whenever a woman would have some devastation, she'd be a good dancer, and then if something happened bad, she's in church. So it was for weak people. And I talked about there was a God somewhere. I just didn't believe in religion. So I'm there fighting in that room trying to, I said, well, I'm not going to die. I've got everything to live for. And I heard a voice right within my thoughts. You believe in God? Why are you scared to die? Sure, everybody believe in God, but I'm not going to die in a dressing room. I started exercising, trying to keep my life in me, walking back and forward. I'm not going to die. And I remember, I'm going to make a deal. Everybody likes money. Because I knew now that these were not my thoughts. I said, I'm still George Foreman. I can box and give money to charities and help cancer. And the voice answered right within my thoughts. I don't want your money. I want you. I said, there's nobody I've ever met turning down money. And that changed my life. I was fighting for my life. In a split second, I remember my legs giving out on me. And I remember saying, God, I believe in you. Before I could say another word, I was in a deep dog nothing. Over my head, under my feet, I was nothing. I existed no more. And this horrible smell that goes along with it, I was dead. In this vision, I was like a man dropped off into the sea with no ships or nowhere. And I said, well, I talked about there being a God. I said, I don't care if this is death. I still believe there's a God. And it was like a giant hand, when I said that, reached into this nothing and pulled me out. And I was alive in this dressing room with blood flowing through my veins. I'd been dead, and I was alive. And everybody standing over me, evidently picking me off the floor, laid me on the table. And I remember saying, I'm dying, but tell everybody I'm dying for God. And everybody's like, George, you can win another boxing match. Don't worry about it. I said, I'm not worrying about a boxing match. And as I laid on that table, my doctor who traveled with me, evidently holding my head, I told him, move your hands, Dr. West. The thorns on his head are making him bleed. I didn't believe in this stuff, and I told my masseur, move your hand, Mr. Fuller. He's bleeding where they crucified him. Next thing you know, I'm fighting in the room, trying to take a shower, saying words like, I'm born again. Hallelujah, I'm clean. And I haven't stopped telling that story since 1977. It changed my life. To explain it, I haven't gotten that smart yet.
When you say you thought you were dying then, was that because of blows you took in the ring, or was it something unrelated to what happened in the ring?
Oh, later on, I remember everybody knew something had happened to me in the dressing room. They rushed me to the hospital. They put me in intensive care. They never found anything wrong with me. And so my trainer, manager, one of my trainers came in, Gil Clancy. He said, George, I've told the press that you have heat prostration. Never heard the word. I said, how do you say that? Heat prostration. He said, when they come into the room, say it. I said, I don't know how to say it. We practiced a few times. Then the reporters came in. I said, I got heat prostration. Before I forgot how to pronounce it, I say it. Never heard of the word, but I was thinking of excuses too. Maybe I was hit too hard. Maybe I went without water. Maybe I, anything, but not what happened to me. This had not, I'm a champion. I'm a playboy. I got a life ahead of me. I'm not into religion. I tried to shake this out of my mind.
So when you found religion, did you feel like you needed to give up boxing?
Well, I had this rage that motivated me to become champ of the world. I wanted to kill somebody and beat everybody. When I left that room, I thought about in this experience that I had in that room, I'm about to die. And the only thing that came to my mind, I had not said goodbye to my mother. And I had a little baby. You know, I hadn't said goodbye to my children. I'm dead in this dirty old nasty dressing room. I got homes and cars all over the world. I'm going to die in this dirty dressing room without saying bye. You understand? And all my life I'd pursued and wanted people to show me that they loved me and cared about me. And here I am in this moment. All I wanted to do was say goodbye. So in this room, I left out that night not wanting people to love me. I said, I got another chance to live and let people know I love them. And it changes your whole life. I got to rush home and hug my mother. I got to rush home and say, tell my kids I love them and my sisters, my brothers, hi. You know, I forgot, I left them with a frown on my face thinking I was going to see them again. So, excuse me, I'm turned backwards. My whole life is turned up. I'm in a rush now to go out and change things. So there was no time for a killer instinct or to get psyched up.
Now, this story that you told about how you didn't used to, you not only didn't used to believe, but you used to think religion was for weak people.
It was, to me.
I bet you tell that story to people all the time. I bet you told that story a lot. To other people who think, like you once thought, that religion is for weak people.
Yeah, I really did. I remember thinking of a guy, you know, with a Bible. He has to be someone who can't fight. I can fight. You go up in school and you see a kid go to school and he has a strange look on him. His parents take him to church. He's not allowed to fight. You could take his lunch money. You could do anything to this kid. You know, I'm not going to turn into that. So I tell this story over and over why I just didn't see how religion could fit into a winner's life.
My guest is heavyweight champion George Foreman. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with George Foreman. You grew up in poverty.
Mm-hmm.
When you were really young, like before you were 16, you would rob, you'd mug people, steal money. And you said you really had no conscience.
No.
Back then. Is there a turning point where you felt like you developed a conscience, where you developed empathy for the people who you might have been mugging a few years before?
It's strange because ignorance, it's almost sad because if you get into a life of poverty, you're almost married to ignorance. Not having a book, not having a proper role models, it's the worst thing that could happen to human beings. So there I am running the street, mugging people as a teenager, robbing, stealing just to buy wine and cigarettes because everybody's doing it. Not because I'm a criminal. One night the police chased me. I had to run under a house to hide. And I covered myself with mud so the dogs wouldn't sniff me out. And I remembered a criminal running from the police on a TV show, going into the water so the dogs couldn't sniff him. It was my only education. Hey, man, you're a criminal. I didn't want to be that. I didn't want to be a criminal. I was just robbing people, if you know what I mean. But it was that recognition that I was a criminal that I crawled from under that house at about 15. I said, I'll never steal again. I'm not a criminal. If you know what I mean. So embracing and growing up in ignorance is probably greater than poverty because even ignorance can embrace someone with money. And I was ignorant thinking that I was hurting people. And so the idea that I was a criminal made me start to say, hey, well, if you're not a criminal, you wouldn't hurt people. You wouldn't take their money. It changed me right then. You could lay $1,000 in front of me at that point. I was not going to touch it because I felt like, hey, you're covering yourself with mud again. And I didn't want to be covered in my life with mud. That little television show, you know, it's very important that kids are educated and in any kind of way they can about what is right and what is wrong. I think that today the prisons are loaded with kids who are there, don't even know why. It's real.
What's your ministry like now?
Well, I still preach love. The doctrine that I preach is about love. I'm an evangelist, which means I go to certain towns and there are a lot of people will come out to auditoriums and buildings to hear me talk. And I talk about Jesus. That's all it is to sell this product that I use. I mean, I never go out selling one product and smelling like another. I love this, and I try to tell people about peace of mind, and you can only find it with the recognition and belief that God is alive and that his son is too. And that's all it is about. And, of course, I devote myself to a lot of time going out speaking to kids unrelated to church work, just inspiring them to believe in their country, that if you really want something, this is the most compassionate society, and it never gives up on its underprivileged.
When you started boxing, you used rage, anger, to motivate you in the ring. You work with a lot of young people now, and I'm sure you see a lot of rage out in the streets, unchanneled rage, or rage that's kind of aimlessly channeled. Do you do anything to try to channel that rage?
Yeah, I remember crawled from under that house in 1964. I didn't know what to do with my life. I still didn't want to steal anymore, but I heard a commercial, Jimmy Brown saying, if you're looking for an extra chance in life, join the Job Corps. You can make something out of your life. So that celebrity influenced my life. If he had said, jump off a bridge, I would have done that too, or whatever. So today, what I try to do is I'm out there doing commercials. I do a lot of things so people can focus on me and at the same time understand that I have no desire to be anything but a human being. Muscles don't mean anything without dedication to your community. You know, they got to see that in you. I'm not losing my temper, things like that. So you can say more by being a certain way than saying a lot of things.
Do you tell them not to be angry or to try to use the anger?
You don't say anything to young people. Uh-huh. The worst thing you can do is run your mouth too much. They're looking right through you like a lion and a tiger. Be that, and they will interpret it. They see, and they are subjective to what they see, and they see a lot more than adults. And just be the best you can and be out there so they can meet you, and don't give them any sermon at all. But that's what we need, a lot of guys who are that and not who say they are that. Just be that.
Is it true that all of your sons are named George?
We have four boys, all named George Edward Foreman.
Why did you name them all George?
That was a pretty good name.
Okay.
You were trying to talk about my name? Take that. No, but literally, I didn't find out who my biological father was until after I had lost the title of the world. I had already had taste devastation. Then one sister came up to me and said, you know, daddy is not your daddy. I said, what do you mean? You want to fight? She said, nope. And I had to search and find this guy. And I only became friends with him. We were friends maybe, I don't know, 2 years. And he was dead. I didn't know anything about that man. And I figured I better do something. All my boys, I'm not going to one junior and then another. I'm going to name them all George Foreman. They're going to have to sort it out and understand more about it as they get older. But I have to, when you can't find roots, plant something. And George is a good root.
Now, one last question. When you learned how to box, did it teach you things beyond boxing? Did it expose you early on to things, you know, to things you felt you would have otherwise never have known about or been exposed to?
Oh, boxing really helped me. Like all sports, you get a chance to travel.
Discipline.
Meet other people. You know, hey, I got to go to sleep.
Right.
If you're going to make it big, you got to give up. You got to give up smoking and drinking. Mm-hmm. It opened up a whole nother world for me. As a matter of fact, you'd be lonely hours. You pick up a book, start to read books. a whole world because you got so much time on your hand. You don't want to waste it. The greatest thing it introduced me to was a book.
What books made a big impression on you?
Mostly autobiographies and little self-help things, basic mathematics, business law. Here I am. The points where you put a zero behind a zero became very important to me. Percentages. You know, if you don't know, they would take your money.
Right.
And one period in the wrong spot could mean a difference between you having an egg sandwich or a steak sandwich. So you have to start studying and learning out things. No one was there to look out for you but your own self. Books became my love, my life.
What's your next fight?
This is my last year to box. I will not box beyond 1995.
Why?
If I can get another title shot or someone to fight or Mike Tyson or something like that, I will box. But I've given my word to my family and myself that I'm going to reap the fruits of my hard labor. I'm not going to be a boxer forever. I don't think I'm going to quit because I'm too old. It's just that I've climbed the hill. There's no more challenge. And that's why. You got to have a reason to box. You just can't be out there making money at boxing. You just can't. That's not motivation enough.
But it's what motivated you to get back in, though.
Yeah, it motivated me
because
to become champ
it.
Of the world. But once I'm champ of the world, and I made money prior to being champ of the world, so I've satisfied the goals, and you just can't wander aimlessly out there. You got to know where you're going, and I've done as much as I wanted to do as a boxer.
George Foreman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
George Foreman has written a new autobiography called By George. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have about Bosnia?
Well, we'll be hearing from Tom Gelton about today's hearings on Capitol Hill, where, among others, Defense Secretary William Perry was questioned about U.S. policy in the former Yugoslav Republic. We'll also be hearing from Misha Glenny about the Serbs' interest in a greater Serbia. Also on today's program, news of the anti-terrorism bill going through the Congress, a federal advisory commission giving its advice on how we should change immigration policies, and we'll be hearing about the U.S. women's soccer team, which has tied its first game. It's the defending champion in the World Championships in Sweden.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says that for the ultimate summer reading indulgence, nothing beats the experience of reading a biography about harried overachievers while you're relaxing in the sun. For part two of her summer reading roundup, Maureen reviews two biographies, No Ordinary Time by Doris Kearns Goodwin and Babe, a biography about champion athlete Babe Didrikson Zaharias.
First time round, I had to stop reading halfway through No Ordinary Time, Doris Kearns Goodwin's moving biography about the personal and political struggles of Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt. This was back in January when I experienced too much cognitive dissonance in reading about the New Deal, at the very same moment that a new crop of politicians was hell-bent on dismantling what was left of it. A more recent encounter with No Ordinary Time has left me not flattened, but flabbergasted. Every page of Goodwin's in-depth book is studded with quotes from White House maids, defense plant workers, and Roosevelt relatives. Yet the narrative flows as smoothly as one of Franklin's fireside chats. What's also amazing to me is the sheer energy of Goodwin's subjects. Here's one instance. On the spring day in 1943 that Franklin left for the first Quebec conference, where he would hammer out the details of Operation Overlord, Eleanor flew off to the South Pacific, where she toured field hospitals, gave speeches, and managed to file her 400-word newspaper column every day. Goodwin describes how someone remarked to Franklin that Eleanor would be very tired when she returned to Washington. No, Franklin joked, but she will tire everybody else. To her credit, Eleanor did, pressuring Franklin on homefront issues like civil rights and bugging industrialist Henry Kaiser to install daycare centers in his factories. The contagious, willed optimism of Franklin and Eleanor that helped transform the nation and win the war is a force that still radiates off the pages of Goodwin's book. Like Eleanor and Franklin, Babe Diedrichson Zaharias also had plenty of pep. She won 2 gold medals in track and field in the 1932 Olympics and then went on to victories in basketball, baseball, tennis, bowling, and golf. Susan Califf's biography, Babe, traces her astonishing career and also provides a capsule history of women's sports in America. But most ambitiously, Califf shows how Babe's transformation from a rock'em sock'em tomboy to a lipsticked lady golfer demonstrates how sexual identity is in part a learned performance. When Babe started out in the 1930s, women athletes were stigmatized as inverts, the medical term for lesbians. Babe's participation in masculine-type sports and her butch appearance made her especially suspect. One male sports wit wrote, "Babe cannot compete with other girls in the very ancient and honorable sport of man-trapping." The criticism finally got to Babe, who in the mid-1930s gave herself a femme makeover and married wrestler George Zaharias. Their union inspired the Tracy Hepburn romance movie Pat and Mike, but Califf discloses that, for the last 6 years of the marriage, Babe maintained an intimate relationship with younger golfer Betty Dodd. Dodd lived with Babe and George in a tense domestic triangle until Babe's death in 1956. Califf's academically oriented Babe lacks the stylistic sparkle of Goodwin's biography, and Babe herself is a tough dame to wholeheartedly like. But Babe the biography is a fascinating investigation into the mysteries of sexuality, as well as into the psyche of a great woman athlete who never let her breasts get in the way.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu, Nancy Updike, Barbara Bogave, and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Becky Cohen. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. Additional funding comes from Farrer, Straus, and Giroux, publisher of The Coming Plague, Laurie Garrett's book about the outbreak of infectious diseases from Ebola to AIDS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Senators want reassurance that American soldiers won't go to Bosnia on a pretext to get them involved in the Bosnian War. Defense Secretary William Perry has told them that the U.S. won't take sides and would only enter Bosnia to rescue peacekeepers who are in trouble.
We will not participate in UNPROFOR in the ground forces. We will not participate in the Rapid Reaction Force with ground forces. We continue to provide the air support, and we have for some time said that we would assist in a withdrawal of the UNPROFOR forces.
The Clinton administration continues to support the continuation of the UN Protection Force mission in Bosnia. Secretary Perry says pulling the peacekeepers out would lead to a humanitarian disaster. President Clinton has vetoed his first bill. The president says he can't sign legislation that cuts more than $16 billion in spending because it slices education to the bone and increases pork barrel spending. Mr. Clinton says he doesn't want to be an obstructionist.
I do not want to just say no. I have not said no to this. I agreed to the spending cuts passed by the Senate by Republicans and Democrats. And so what I'm going to do when I veto this is to say yes, I'm going to send this bill right back. And this bill says take out the pork, put back the education, send it on over. Let's cut spending and protect education and protect safety.
Mr. Clinton's objectives are, or rather, objects over a relatively narrow $1.4 billion segment of the cuts. The government says foreign investment in the United States was way up last year by 80%. NPR's Laura Kanoy has details.
The Commerce Department says foreign companies poured more than $47 billion into the U.S. economy in 1994, compared to $26 billion the year before. The department pointed to several reasons for the increase. Stronger growth in Western Europe meant foreign companies had more money to invest here. The U.S. economy continued to expand, and a lower dollar made everything cheaper. Nearly all of the foreigners bought existing American businesses instead of setting up new firms. More than half of the investments were in manufacturing. Other major outlays were in the communications and utilities industries. The biggest spender was Britain, with about 40% of the total, then Switzerland, Canada, and Germany. The Commerce Department said Japan's share was much lower than in years past, $2 billion last year versus $20 billion in 1990. This is Laura Kanoy in Washington.
Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan says there's been quite a pronounced economic slowdown. He believes this has increased the chance for a recession. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down more than 24 points at 4,460. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. Federal authorities say they have broken up the largest Canadian-American counterfeiting case in U.S. history. Richard Block of member station WRVO reports.
50-year-old Joseph Bagdasarian from Montreal, Canada, pled guilty to printing approximately $24 million in counterfeit $100 bills. Authorities believe the bogus bills have been distributed all across North America since early 1992. So far, 253 individuals have been arrested for passing and or distributing the counterfeit money. Bagdasarian operated out of a chalet in Quebec. Gregory West is an assistant United States attorney.
Hundreds and hundreds of innocent citizens were saved the loss and the expense of accepting these very high-quality counterfeit $100 notes, which they would ultimately be left with without any recourse.
Authorities have no idea how much counterfeit money remains outstanding. Bagdasarian was sentenced to 41 months in prison. For National Public Radio, I'm Richard Block in Syracuse, New York.
Doctors for former baseball star Mickey Mantle say he has liver cancer and hepatitis C. Doctors told reporters today in Dallas that Mantle is on a list to receive a liver transplant. They hope that it happens within 3 to 4 weeks. Mantle is very weak and he cannot get out of bed alone. The baseball star has said that he drank heavily for many years. Doctors say the hepatitis was the result of blood transfusions. A Japanese official is advising caution about reports of progress in nuclear talks between the United States and North Korea. The diplomat says that the world shouldn't assume that all is well until the negotiations are actually over. American and North Korean officials say they have made progress on details of a pact to shut down the North's nuclear weapons program, but they won't say exactly what they've accomplished. A major block has been the North's refusal to accept new reactors made in South Korea. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington. From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, says the United States should send troops into Bosnia only under one condition, if United Nations forces are attacked. UPI's Carol Van Dam reports.
The Speaker says if United Nations forces are attacked in Bosnia-Herzegovina, U.S. forces should help intervene in a massive, decisive manner.
We should recognize that the Europeans have thousands of their soldiers at risk. At the same time, we should send a clear signal that if anything happened to the UN forces, that we would, of course, intervene decisively and with massive power, and we would make sure that the UN forces were able to get out. I mean, we would not tolerate the forces being put at risk.
Yesterday, Gingrich blasted the Clinton administration for what's been described as a confused Bosnian policy. Carol Van Dam, Capitol Hill.
Reports from the Serbian border say three more United Nations peacekeepers are free. Reporters say the three UN military observers crossed into Serbia today. They joined 108 peacekeepers who were freed overnight. 232 UN hostages have been released since Friday, but the Serbs still hold 145 more as insurance against NATO airstrikes. Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman John Shalikashvili has told senators that signals detected in northern Bosnia, where a fighter pilot was shot down, cannot be linked to the missing flyer. Shalikashvili told the Senate Armed Services Committee today there have been reports of an intermittent signal from the region that are linked to the pilot, but he says defense officials have not been able to link this themselves. A Florida mother avoided a death sentence today for her role in the murder of her young daughter. Wayne Rustin of member station WINZ reports.
Pauline Zile will spend the rest of her life in prison for a first-degree murder conviction for last September's beating death of 7-year-old daughter Christina Holt. Palm Beach County Prosecutor Marianne Duggan sought a death sentence but is not disappointed by the outcome.
Pauline Zile will spend the rest of her life in prison as long as there's no change in the sentencing format. And that's just. To me, it's about a little girl who died at 7 and should still be here.
Zile's defense attorneys are appealing the conviction because they feel an unsympathetic jury found Zile guilty for concocting a child abduction story to cover up the murder. Husband John Zile goes to trial in August on the same first-degree murder charge. For National Public Radio, I'm Wayne Rustin in West Palm Beach, Florida.
A published report says hard times are coming to Sesame Street. The New York Times reports the producer of the children's public television show has laid off 47 people. That's a 12% cut for the nonprofit Children's Television Workshop. On Wall Street today, stock prices closed lower. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 23 points to end at 4,462. Declining issues led advances by a margin of more than 4-3 in heavy trading. The price of an average share was down 16 cents. This is NPR. There appears to be a breakthrough in the long stalemated talks between the United States and North Korea aimed at dismantling the North's suspected nuclear weapons program. Both sides have been meeting in Kuala Lumpur for the past 2 weeks. From Tokyo, NPR's Julie McCarthy reports.
Officials on both sides were talking optimistically today about progress. Neither side, however, would divulge what issues they've resolved in the 7-month-long negotiations. North Korea has been insisting that the nuclear reactors it agreed to accept be designated made in the USA. The agreement signed last year said South Korea would provide whatever new generation of nuclear technology the North would get. A North Korea news agency dispatch said today both sides have reached agreement on a reactor model and the liabilities of the United States. Whether that represents a change on the American part is not clear. South Korean newspapers did report today a demand by the North for add-ons to the deal that would cost another $1 billion have been spurned by the U.S. In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
British government medical experts say there's no such thing as Gulf War syndrome. British lawmakers heard today from four medical experts from the Defense Ministry. One says, based on the evidence, there isn't a syndrome as such. Many U.S. veterans have complained of illnesses following service in the Gulf. A National Institutes of Health committee reported 2 months ago that it believes the syndrome is real, but involves many illnesses with overlapping symptoms and causes. The death toll has risen in the massive earthquake on Russia's Sakhalin Island. It now stands at 1,743. 167 people are still missing and presumed dead. No survivors have been found since early Saturday in the ruins of what was once the oil town of Neftogorsk. The town collapsed early May 28th when an earthquake measured at 7.5 on the Richter scale shook the town. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.